Here we go with 1 Samuel chapters 8 and 9. When Samuel became old, he made his sons judges over Israel. The name of his firstborn son was Joel, and the name of his second, Abijah. They were judges in Beersheba, yet his sons did not follow in his ways, but turned aside after gain. They took bribes and perverted justice. All the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah, and said to him, "You are old, and your sons do not follow in your ways. Appoint for us then a king to govern us like other nations." But the thing displeased Samuel when they said, "Give us a king to govern us." Samuel prayed to the Lord, and the Lord said to Samuel, "Listen to the voice of the people and all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from being king over them, just as they have done to me from the day I brought them up out of Egypt to this day, forsaking me and serving other gods, so also they are doing to you. Now then, listen to their voice. Only you shall solemnly warn them and show them the ways of the king who shall reign over them." So Samuel reported all the words of the Lord to the people who were asking him for a king. He said, "These will be the ways of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them to his chariots and to be his horsemen and to run before his chariots. And he will appoint for himself commanders of thousands and commanders of fifties, and some to plow his ground and to reap his harvest and to make his implements of war and the equipment of his chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers. He will take the best of your fields and vineyards and olive orchards and give them to his courtiers. He will take one-tenth of your grain and of your vines and give it to his officers and his courtiers. He will take your male and female slaves and the best of your cattle and donkeys and put them to his work. He will take one-tenth of your flocks, and you shall be his slaves. And in that day you will cry out because of your king, whom you have chosen for yourselves, but the Lord will not answer you in that day." But the people refused to listen to the voice of Samuel. They said, "No, but we are determined to have a king over us, so that we also may be like other nations, and that our king may govern us and go out before us and fight our battles." When Samuel had heard all the words of the people, he repeated them in the ears of the Lord. The Lord said to Samuel, "Listen to their voice and set a king over them." Samuel then said to the people of Israel, "Each of you return home." There was a man of Benjamin whose name was Kish, son of Abiel, son of Zeror, son of Bechorath, son of Aphiah, a Benjamite, a man of wealth. He had a son whose name was Saul, a handsome young man. There was not a man among the people of Israel more handsome than he. He stood head and shoulders above everyone else. Now the donkeys of Kish, Saul's father, had strayed. So Kish said to his son Saul, "Take one of the boys with you. Go and look for the donkeys." He passed through the hill country of Ephraim and passed through the land of Shalishah, but they did not find them. And they passed through the land of Sha'alim, but they were not there. Then he passed through the land of Benjamin, but they did not find them. When they came to the land of Zuph, Saul said to the boy who was with him, "Let us turn back, or my father will stop worrying about the donkeys and worry about us." But he said to him, "There is a man of God in this town. He is a man held in honor. Whatever he says always comes true. Let us go there now. Perhaps he will tell us about the journey on which we have set out." Then Saul replied to the boy, "But if we go, what can we bring the man? For the bread in our sacks is gone, and there is no present to bring to the man of God. What have we?" The boy answered Saul again, "Here, I have with me a quarter shekel of silver. I will give it to the man of God to tell us our way." Formerly in Israel, anyone who went to inquire of God would say, "Come, let us go to the seer." For the one who is now called a prophet was formerly called a seer. Saul said to the boy, "Good, come, let us go." So they went to the town where the man of God was. As they went up the hill to the town, they met some girls coming out to draw water, and said to them, "Is the seer here?" They answered, "Yes, there he is just ahead of you. Hurry, He has come just now to town because the people have a sacrifice today at the shrine. As soon as you enter the town, you will find him before he goes up to the shrine to eat. For the people will not eat until he comes, since he must bless the sacrifice. Afterward, those eat who are invited. Now go up, for you will meet him immediately. So they went up to the town. As they were entering the town, they saw Samuel coming out toward them on his way up to the shrine. Now the day before Saul came, the Lord had revealed to Samuel, "Tomorrow, about this time, I will send to you a man from the land of Benjamin, and you shall anoint him to be ruler over my people Israel. He shall save my people from the hand of the Philistines, for I have seen the suffering of my people, because their outcry has come to me." When Samuel saw the Lord told him, "Here is the man of whom I spoke to you. He it is who shall rule over my people." Then Saul approached Samuel inside the gate and said, "Tell me, please, where is the house of the seer?" Samuel answered Saul, "I am the seer. Go up before me to the shrine, for today you shall eat with me, and in the morning I will let you go and will tell you all that is on your mind. As for your donkeys that were lost 3 days ago, give no further thought to them, for they have been found. And on whom is all Israel's desire fixed, if not on you and all your ancestral house?" Saul answered, "I am only a Benjaminite, from the least of the tribes of Israel, and my family is the humblest of all the families of the tribe of Benjamin. Why then have you spoken to me in this way?" Then Samuel took Saul and his servant boy and brought them into the hall and gave them a place at the head of those who had been invited, of whom there were about 30. And Samuel said to the cook, "Bring the portion I gave you, the one I asked you to put aside." The cook took up the thigh and what went with it and set them before Saul. Samuel said, "See, what was kept is set before you. Eat, for it is set before you at the appointed time, so that you might eat with the guests." So Saul ate with Samuel that day. When they came down from the shrine into the town, a bed was spread for Saul on the roof, and he lay down to sleep. Then at the break of dawn, Samuel called to Saul upon the roof, "Get up, so that I may send you on your way." Saul got up, and both he and Samuel went out into the street. As they were going down to the outskirts of the town, Samuel said to Saul, "Tell the boy to go on before us, and when he has passed on, stop here yourself for a while, that I may make known to you the word of God." The word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
Okay. So, between chapter 7 and chapter 8, apparently a considerable amount of time has passed because Samuel's old now, and basically he's passed along the job of being judges to his sons, Joel and Abijah, and unfortunately, very much like Eli's sons, these are naughty boys. They're corrupt, they're taking bribes, and perverting justice. And so it's sad that Samuel, who displaced the sons of Eli, now finds himself in a very similar situation to Eli. And the people are upset, and so they come to Samuel and they say, "You're old, and your sons are bad. We want a king." And Samuel was very upset about this because it was a personal insult. You know, you're not getting the job done. Your boys aren't getting the job done. And not only do we want new and better judges, we want something completely different. So Samuel prays to God, and God sort of comforts him. He says, "Listen, this isn't about you. Don't take it personally. This is actually about me. They're rejecting me, and they've been doing this ever since I brought them out of Egypt. They've been serving other gods. You'll remember from our study of Exodus a while back, you know, when Moses was on the mountain, that they went to Aaron and they created a golden calf and they worshipped it. They really never stopped. They just couldn't resist the allure of idolatry. And so God said, "We're going to give them what they want. But I'm going to, you know, tell you what they're in for, and you're going to warn them about this." So Samuel goes back to the people and he says, "You know, this king that you're asking for, you have no idea. You have no idea. He's going to conscript your sons into the army. He's going to turn them into royal servants. And They're going to have to drive his chariots, and he's going to take a tenth of your harvest and your herds and your vineyards, and on top of the tithe that was due to God. You know, so now 20% of everything you've got is going to not be yours anymore. Your daughters are going to be brought into the royal households to serve as servants, to bake and to cook and to perfume. And, you know, basically, you have no idea what you're getting yourself into. But they ignore him because they're so determined to be like other nations. You know, they've enjoyed the idols of other nations, and now they want to have a political system similar to that, ostensibly because they feel like they'll be stronger in a kingdom with a unifying force and a king, so that they can be more successful in their regular battles with their neighbors for territory and supremacy. And, of course, it's a specious argument because they'd actually be doing quite well with the judges. You know, they didn't need a king when they came out of the wilderness and conquered the promised land under the leadership of Joshua, who was a general, not a king. And so Samuel goes back, praise the Lord again, and he says, you know, do it anyway. So Samuel sends them home. And then very abruptly, this shifts to the story of Saul. And it's going to be brought back around by the end of the chapter and into chapter 10. That he's from the tribe of Benjamin, and this was the smallest of all the tribes, and it's believed that Benjamin was the youngest son of Jacob. And as we know, primogeniture played an important role in that society, so if you were the youngest of 12 sons, you were seriously out of luck. And his father was a man of wealth, and Saul himself was handsome and tall. And a physical appearance was very important in Scripture as a sign of divine favor. Probably the most prominent example is David, who again was the youngest son, but the one that was selected to succeed Saul as king. We can think of others. Joseph was a very attractive young man, as was Moses. If you look back in Exodus chapter 2, verse 2, when he was a baby, handsome baby. And so you already get a hint that Saul is up for great things, despite his humble origins. And this, again, is a reflection of some of what Hannah sang in chapter 2, that the humble would be exalted and the exalted would be humbled. The way the story gets started is there's some missing donkeys. And so Daddy says, boy, take one of the boys with you and find these donkeys. And so they sort of wander around. We're not really sure where any of these locations are, but they travel a considerable distance trying to find these donkeys. And they finally get to the land of Zuph, and Saul's ready to call it quits. He's like, you know, if we're away from much longer, Dad's going to be worried more about us than he is about the donkeys. And the boy says, you know, wait a minute. There's still hope. There's a man of God in this town. And if we petition him, perhaps he will receive some kind of divine insight that will tell us where the donkeys are. And he says, Saul says, well, we got a problem. We're out of supplies. We've eaten all of our bread. And, you know, the custom was if you went to a man of God to ask for some kind of favor, you would provide some sort of gift. It wasn't payment. It was just an offering, a way to honor this sacred, consecrated person. And the boy says, well, now, just wait a minute. I actually happen to have an eighth of a shekel. Now, a shekel was about he had a quarter of a shekel. A shekel was about a half of an ounce, and so what they're looking at is 1/16 of an ounce of silver. So it's not a lot, but it's something. It's better than nothing. And so they head on toward town, and verse 9 has this parenthetical comment about back in the old days, the people we now call prophets were called seers. And this is probably a later editorial emendation to clarify that Samuel was more than just a seer, more than just a holy man, but he was in fact a prophet. There's a measure of overlap between those two roles, but the prophet aspect is one that needs to be emphasized in this context of the establishment of the monarchy and what will follow it, because the role of the prophets was significantly more powerful than that of a mere seer. It was also more rare. So that's what the parenthetical comment is about. They head into town and they see some girls coming out to draw water, and they ask if he's there, and he says, yeah, but you need to hustle up because there's been a sacrifice at the shrine, and they can't eat it until he gets there, and he's going up to the feast, and only certain people are invited, so ostensibly if they don't get to Samuel before he's into the feast, they're going to have to wait until the next day because they've not been invited. They go in, they see Samuel on his way to the shrine, so they catch him just in time. And the day before, God had told Samuel, tomorrow, around about this same time, there's going to be a guy from the tribe of Benjamin, and he's the one you're looking for. This is the guy you're going to anoint as king. And it's interesting because in the second half of verse 16, God has told Samuel, he shall save my people from the hand of the Philistines, for I have seen the suffering of my people because their outcry has come to me. And, you know, it's a sort of a reversal in a way, because one of the reasons the people gave for wanting a king in the first place was to have a more solid political and military system to protect themselves against their neighbors. And God, who previously has denied this as a kind of a spurious claim, is now embracing it as a reasonable concern and echoing this Exodus language of, you know, I've seen the suffering of my people, their outcry has come to me. This is the language that God used when he was recruiting Moses to come back and be his instrument to appeal to Pharaoh for the release of the Hebrews. And it's also an apparent contradiction to what God has already said in chapter 8, verse 18, where he says, and in that day you will cry out because of your king, whom you have chosen for yourself, but the Lord will not answer you in that day. So on the one hand, in chapter 8, when God's warning people through Samuel that having a king is a really bad idea and you'll come to regret it, and when you start whining to me about it, I'm going to ignore you, and I'm not going to give you an answer, or rather your answer is going to be conquest by the Assyrians and then the Babylonians, which we'll read about when we get to 2 Kings. And here in chapter 9, verse 16b, God seems to have relented to a certain extent and embraced at least one of the reasons why the people wanted a king. And so Samuel sees Saul. God kind of whispers in his ear, you remember what we talked about yesterday? This is the guy. This is the guy. So Saul approaches Samuel, and he's looking for the seer, and he says, well, lucky day for you, that's me. And before Saul even has a chance to ask about the donkey, Samuel sort of preempts him, and he says, you know, I was going up for dinner. Why don't you join me, and tomorrow morning we'll talk about the things that are on your mind, because these donkeys that you lost 3 days ago, don't worry about that, because in a very short time, a handful of donkeys will be the least of your concerns, because you're going to be wealthy beyond all imagining, and if some donkeys wander off, that's really not going to be a problem for you. Saul's perplexed because he comes from the smallest of all the tribes and claims that he's from the humblest of all the clans within that tribe, which seems a little bit of an exaggeration because his father is described at the beginning of chapter 8 as a wealthy man. But again, this is reinforcing the theme of the exaltation of the humble and the pattern that we see consistently in Scripture of an unexpected person, a person of humble circumstances being elevated to great power. You know, we've seen that in Joseph. We've seen that in Moses. I mean, he had kind of a checkered past. He was a murderer, for one thing, justifiable, but nevertheless. He was a baby, abandoned by necessity, raised in Pharaoh's house, a person with 1 foot in two different worlds. You can look at somebody like David. They didn't even bother to present him in front of the prophet as a potential future king because he was so young. And they actually had to bring him in from the fields for his sort of coming out in front of the prophet. And so this is just another event in a long pattern where God is an underdog God. And we need to never forget that, that God is an underdog God. But he's perplexed. Why are you talking to me like this? And Samuel doesn't answer him. He just takes Saul and his servant boy. They go up to the hall. And Samuel gives Saul this sort of choice portion of the sacrifice. It would have been the thigh and some other part connected to the thigh. It's not clear here. It says the thigh and what went with it. And in your footnote, like it says in my Bible, it may seem meaning of Hebrew uncertain. And when you start digging into commentaries, they've got all sorts of ideas about what this is about. But anyway, you know, he's the guy that, like, got the best part of the animal. And that was usually reserved for the priest. And in a way, this sort of puts Saul in a pseudo-priestly role, which is unusual for somebody who has been divinely foreordained to become king. But remember that Israelite kingship had priestly aspects to it as well. They weren't entirely unified roles, but we can think of David dancing around the Ark of the Covenant when it was restored to Jerusalem, and the fact that he wrote so many of the psalms that were used in temple worship. So Saul has a nice dinner. Afterwards, they put him on the roof of somebody's house, which was the best place to be because it was cool up there. You had better ventilation. So this, again, was a sort of a place of honor. And then at dawn, Samuel comes to Saul and says, "Okay, time to leave." And they're walking down the street, and Samuel says, "Let your valet go on ahead of you, because we have some things to discuss in secret. And this is sort of the prelude, to what will happen in chapter 10, when Samuel will anoint Saul as a Mashiach, Messiah. Not in the way that we think of Messiah, but in the Old Testament concept where a king and others could be anointed for particular divine purposes and be an anointed one. That's what Mashiach means, anointed one. We'll get to that next week, but he's going to share with him now what God has told him and what Saul's future is going to be. So it's a fascinating sequence leading up to the creation of the monarchy, starting with Saul. And MacArthur, in his commentary in the Anchor Bible series, says, "Everywhere the lineaments of the Eden story are apparent. We have here a reflection of a traditional pattern found more than once in the Hebrew Bible, which presents men striving to exceed divinely appointed boundaries and holds the tragic consequences up to view." Here he's referring to the desire for a king and the warning that they ignored. "The people demand a king of Samuel, because they want to be like the other nations. But this is precisely what they are not supposed to be. Throughout their history, they've called to be a different people, a distinctive people, to serve as a light to the nations so that all might be drawn to acknowledge and worship the glory of the one true God. And they're constantly polluting and corrupting themselves." And, you know, there's this great irony in the story that the people who have come to Samuel because his sons are corrupt judges are themselves corrupt because they want a king. And so it's a fascinating piece of the narrative, and I'll answer whatever questions you have as best as I'm able, and I'm eager to know what your insights are on these two chapters. Beverly.
Who did you say wrote the Psalms?
Well, many of the Psalms are attributed to David. In fact, some people would attribute all 150 of them to him. It was emphasized, it's emphasized in Scripture that he was a man of many talents, and that among other things, he was an extraordinary musician. Yeah. David was, yes. No, David. David did. Yeah. That was when I was talking about the overlap between the kingly and the priestly roles. That is being foreshadowed here where Saul receives the portion of the sacrificial animal that's normally reserved to the presiding priest. Because remember, Samuel started out as a priest. This is a guy that wears a lot of hats, Samuel. He starts out as a priest, helping out with Eli in the tabernacle. He then becomes a judge. Now we realize that he's a seer, but more than a seer, he's also a prophet, and he's a holy man of God. You know, so his resume is just packed. But by giving him the thigh, which is the portion that was traditionally reserved for the priest, we see Saul, who's about to become king, in a sort of a quasi-priestly role. And I just wanted to clarify that there was always a measure of overlap between the two, but the king wasn't the priest, and a priest couldn't be king, but the kings did have priestly duties, and part of the evidence for that was David's role in composing psalms to be offered to God's glory in the temple once it was constructed, and probably prior to that. Thanks for asking that question of clarification. I'm sorry that it wasn't clear initially. Yeah, Daryl. Or Judy. Okay, good.
I'm sorry.
Fire away, and then we'll go to Daryl.
All right. In the footnote, what went with the leg could have been found the tail, which was to
yep.
burned on the altar.
Right.
And the fact, as an oblation to God, mm-hmm. as king, but here it was reserved for Saul mm-hmm. as king.
Yeah, that was one option among many that the commentaries offered. Not all of the fat had to be burned as a sacrifice to God. Some of it could be reserved, but you couldn't keep all of it, you know. And that was, you know, part of the problem with Phinehas and Hophni and Phinehas were basically keeping the very best portions to themselves. But it when you made the sacrifice to God, it wasn't like the way we do now to keep our cholesterol down, where we trim all the fat off all the meat that we eat. You didn't have to go through and scrupulously slice all of it off and dump it onto the altar. It was the fattiest portions that had to go onto the altar or be used as an igniter, if you will, for the incense that was being offered in the holiest of holies. Daryl, and then we'll go to Caroline.
Do you think was it God's will for Israel to never have a king, or maybe just not at this time?
Well, he certainly wasn't happy about it, but he seems to have relented suspiciously easy.
Well, there are references given here back to previous books of the Bible where it certainly sounds like
Well, you know, if you look back at Deuteronomy chapter 17, verse 14, I'm going to read this so you don't have to flip back, but Deuteronomy 17, verse 14, and the citation's in your notes. When you have come into the land that the Lord your God is giving you and have taken possession of it and settled in it, and you say, I will set a king over me like all the nations that are around me, you may indeed set over you a king whom the Lord your God will choose. One of your own community you may set as king over you. You are not permitted to put a foreigner over you who is not of your own community. Even so, he must not acquire many horses for himself, or return the people to Egypt in order to acquire more horses, since the Lord has said to you, you must never return that way again. And so it goes on and on, basically saying all the things that a king cannot do that God warns Samuel, and through Samuel the people, this is what the king will do. And, you know, the issue is it's a mixed record. What exactly did God mean by king? Was he referring to the judges rather than the type of king that Saul and Solomon and David became? Is God basically saying, the type of king you need is me? Because any human king is going to do all the things that I'm saying in Deuteronomy they shouldn't do. But I won't do that to you. So the sovereignty of God, there's a sense in which the idea of having a human king infringes upon the sovereignty of God, and that people are seeking a substitute for God in a king because they don't trust God anymore. And particularly when it comes to battle, you know, because they'd had a bad experience where they got whipped by the Philistines. And they said, we should have brought the Ark of the Covenant with us. So they bring out the Ark of the Covenant, and what happens? They get whipped again, and they lose the Ark of the Covenant. And so they're having some trust issues with Daddy right now. And so they're thinking, you know, maybe an alternative solution is called for. But the system of judges actually worked on balance rather well for them. So they're asking for something that they don't need. They're asking for something that at least implicitly demonstrates a lack of trust in God. Yet at the same time, there are here and there indications that, you know, perhaps God eventually foresaw and intended for them to have a king. The question is, you know, in the divine providence, was God aware that having a king would be necessary for the accomplishment of his purposes? And that God foresaw that the kings initially would be good, would gradually become increasingly bad, and leading to the conquest and the exile and then the restoration and all the events which followed it, leading up to the arrival of Jesus as the Messiah, which would be a very Christian way of interpreting these Hebrew scriptures. And it's just hard to say. But it's pretty clear here that God isn't keen on the idea, but he's going to let them have it in both senses of that phrase. So,
good answer. Thank you.
Because Jesus is King of Kings.
Correct. Caroline, you had something?
It was along those same lines, and I was looking back at some of the notes from the passage in Deuteronomy about what the king originally was supposed to do, and how the king of Israel was supposed to be different from other kings, and that he was still to be under the law. And it says that Deuteronomy greatly restricts royal authority. Generally, here Eastern monarchs promulgated law. Every monarch is subject to the law and requires to read the Torah daily. Deuteronomy even denies the king his typical judicial role as court of last appeal. This law far more emphasizes what the king cannot do than what he can do. And when they go on and talk about that he must not acquire many wives for himself, or else his heart will turn away. Also silver and gold, he must not acquire a great quantity for himself. And it says, the offenses parallel warnings against royal autocracy outlined at the very founding of the monarchy. They likely presuppose Solomon's trade in horses and his multiple foreign wives.
Well, and see, that's the paradox of that passage from Deuteronomy 17. on the surface, it appears as if God is sanctioning a future king, but seriously proscribing the powers of that king. But at the same time, the type of king that God is describing is impossible. You are not going to get a human king like that, which is why some interpret this passage about the king in Deuteronomy 17 is actually God referring to himself in a very sort of subtle and backhanded way, because anybody with half a brain knows that if you put somebody up as king, you actually manage to find Plato's elusive philosopher king or some sort of saintly figure, that these prescriptions are going to be violated freely and repeatedly. And so that's sort of, you could read it either way, or you could read it both ways, you know, where God's saying, I'm the only king that you could possibly have because I'm the only king that can maintain the rules that have set down for a king. Or it may be that God is saying, I'm the only king, but if you want a human king, he has to do this, God full well knowing that would never happen.
Well, do you think the fact that David is considered to be the greatest king that Israel ever had, because he more fit this description than the others?
No, David was a greedy little so-and-so, and he lived in splendor. The reason that David is regarded as great is that he built the temple. I'm sorry, he didn't build the temple. His son Solomon built the temple. David's greatness comes from the fact that he made the preparations for the building of the temple. He is quite eager to do it for himself, but God said, no, you've sort of set things up so that your son can take care of this. But David defeated Goliath as a young man, saving the Israelites from slavery to the Philistines.
He united
the kingdom. He expanded the territory of Israel. He led them successfully in battle. And so he was a great king, especially compared to Saul. You know, nobody ever hurts by comparison. And of course, he was the father of Solomon, who then went on to do remarkable things in his own right. So David's greatness has nothing to do with his adherence to the provisions of kingship provided in Deuteronomy. Nothing whatsoever. He violated every single one of those laws. Judy.
No, that's just what I was saying. He did everything he wasn't supposed to do.
But on the whole, he was faithful. I mean, he stumbled here and there. But again, in comparison with the others, it's everything to a certain extent is relative. I mean, Queen Elizabeth I, in comparison to her predecessor, Queen Mary, is often regarded as a monarch who was much less bloodthirsty and violent and coercive. And to a certain extent, she was. At the same time, she was never particularly shy about having political threats neutralized with the use of capital punishment and a variety of other coercive means. It's just that relative to Mary, she wasn't quite as bloodthirsty. So, yeah. No, okay.
Well, may I temper that a little bit? I think early on she was pretty bloodthirsty, but she lived and reigned for a long time. So
that helped,
if
yeah.
If you average it up, she's good. But if you think about, Mary bumped off all the Episcopalians, if you like.
Yeah.
And then Elizabeth came on, and the first few years she bumped off all the Roman Catholics.
Yeah, and then she went on to reign for what is it? Was she 52 years in the crown? So, yeah, it was the early years that was nasty. And once she sort of put the house in order, she became more tolerant because she realized that that ultimate use of force wasn't necessary. She'd already sort of showed her teeth, whereas Mary had a shorter reign and very happily burned people at the stake throughout it. So,
my Bible has a comment about the worship at a high place in 9:12.
Yeah.
It says that God forbade them to worship or made them take down all the Canaanites.
Yeah, it's it happened, and but we think that. You see, what you have to understand is that the Torah and the historical books were heavily affected by a long-term evolutionary process. And late in the process, when the books that we have sitting here in our Bible reached somewhere close to their final form, there was an editorial redactional effort led by one of four factions called the Deuteronomistic faction, okay? And so what they did was is they shaped this material in a way that conformed to their theological precepts, essentially the theological precepts that were present at the return from exile when they began construction on the Second Temple, which really didn't go anywhere. But, you know, Ezra and Nehemiah is where you can read about this. Those are staunchly priestly and Deuteronomistic books. And so what you have is a prohibition against worshiping in high places. But this is inserted into the Torah in a kind of an after-the-fact manner. And the fact being the establishment of the Temple in Jerusalem. So once you have the Temple in Jerusalem on a high place, that becomes the sole legitimate place for animal sacrifice. And so all of the other high places have to go away. So Bethel doesn't work anymore. And all these other high places that are dotted throughout the territory, they don't work anymore. But it's evident that, you know, God has no objection to places like Bethel and these other high places here in Zuf, where sacrifices can be offered. And this was true not just of Israelites, but of all religions at that time. You'd seek out high places because there's a numinous quality about them that I think any of us who've been up on a mountain can experience. And since, in essence, they were worshiping a sky god who was above them, the idea of being on top of an elevated space meant that you were closer to God. I mean, that's one of the reasons why the great cathedrals of the Middle Ages were, whose can be the tallest? Well, these spires are reaching up to God to sort of connect the divine power down to the horizontal level of the earthly plane. And so the architecture is theology. Or an expression of theology. So it's kind of anachronistic, some of the things that you find in Torah, because they're written after the fact of certain events, like the construction of Solomon's Temple, and woven back into this, and it creates contradictions, because then you have the historical books, which are trying to chronicle, to the best of their ability, actual events, where prior to the establishment of the temple, what do you got? You got yourself a tabernacle at Bethel, and you have a variety of other sort of lesser sacrificial centers like this place at Zuf. So it's complex. And that's what makes the historical books of Samuel, Kings, and Chronicles such a nuisance. We've already talked about the textual problems and the variation in the ancient manuscripts and the lacunae and things like that. And then you combine that with the influence of this Deuteronomistic, I can't say that word right today, the Deuteronomistic, that's the best I can get, their influence on how all this material sort of came off the assembly line, if you will. You know, and their line of thinking is very easily discerned in the book of Genesis in particular, where something called source analysis has been employed to great effect, where you find basically four principal strands of thought, the Yahwistic, the Eloistic, the priestly, and the Deuteronomistic, which is JEPD. Okay? So like Genesis 1 is clearly P. It's priestly. Why do we believe that? Well, for a lot of different reasons. But for one, it's a poem. It's written for memorization and recitation. It's orderly, it's highly structured in comparison to the second creation story, which starts in chapter 2, verse 4, which comes from a different source, Eloistic, if memory serves, but I'm not 100% sure about that. And you don't have this same, and there was evening and morning the first day, yada, yada, yada. This is more of a hurly-burly account, which, you know, is trying to make a theological contribution somewhat distinct from the first creation story. They included both because they wanted both voices to be heard, because they found wisdom in the conversation between the two. You know, and as you go through Genesis, it's hard to unfurl some pieces of it. But there's certainly some sections where you can say, aha, okay, there, yeah, mm-hmm, yeah, okay. So in essence, in Genesis and in other books of the Torah, though most prominently in Genesis, there is a theological conversation going on between four factions who have slightly different ways of seeing God. And the fact that they preserved all four traditions, I think, is a divinely inspired act of wisdom. The recognition that no one camp can have a monopoly on the truth, but it's all four of them together and give us an adequate idea of God's revelation. Judy.
That was my question. Today, are there different camps within Judaism?
Oh, sure. I mean, there's, a spectrum, just like you'd find in Christianity, with sort of, Reform Jews on the one side and ultra-Orthodox Jews on another. And there's variation in terms of the canon within the canon. Yeah, I think we've talked about that before. Everybody has a canon within the canon. And the pieces of Scripture which we find more important than the others, the dominant parts. I mean, there's a reason why we process the gospel out into the midst of the people in public worship, while the other lessons are read stationary at a lectern. It's because for us, the gospels are the books of the Bible through which we read all of the rest. Because they tell the story of Jesus' life and ministry, his teaching, his death, his resurrection, and ascension. Okay? So those are the dominant books for the Christian tradition, and especially for us. And, for some, the Torah is dominant. For others, they would claim that there is no dominant section. And I'm just simply not familiar with that broad spectrum of Judaic thought to provide you with much more in the way of detail in terms of who's where on what. But, you see this in ancient times. One of the big divisions between Jews and Samaritans at the time of Jesus and well before his time was that the Samaritans were very focused on the Torah, and when it came to the works of the prophets and the wisdom literature, pieces like Ecclesiastes and Psalms and Proverbs and Job, they could take or leave that. To them, the Torah was basically all you needed. And, of course, the way they read Torah differed from Judaism, and they felt like that they had a perfectly good mountain to worship God on and didn't need Jerusalem. So you see this division on major topics, happening, well, really, right after the return from exile.
It's really missed the story of the Good Samaritan, all the more meaningful of getting to the heart of the matter, getting to the heart of the gospel, getting to the heart of the message.
Mm-hmm. Well, and if you were here on Thanksgiving Day, you heard the story of the 10 lepers Jesus cleansed, and only one came back, and he was a Samaritan. Making a Samaritan the good guy in a story, that was a real shocker, you know. And the point was to accentuate the fact that we Jews, or you Jews, have been ungrateful to God. You fail to perceive who I am when a Samaritan, who you all regard as stupid and blasphemous and heretical, they get it, but you don't. So what's going on? Because if a Samaritan can get it, and you Jewish brothers and sisters of mine perceive yourself to be so superior to them, then why can't you get it? You know. So it was a sucker punch to the gut every time Jesus made the Samaritan the hero of the story. Yeah, we're going to get into 10 next week, and really, the best way to do this would have been to do chapters 8 and 9, and then to continue into chapter 10 through verse 16. But I just felt like it was too much material for us to cover. I mean, that's a long reading. But what happens in 10 is Samuel anoints Saul, you're going to find your donkeys, you're going to, you know, keep on going. You're going to meet some people at Bethel. There are going to be some signs and symbols. They're going to provide you with some gifts, you're going to go to a Philistine area. Some prophets are going to come down. They're going to play some music for you. You're going to get yourself a little concert. You're going to have an ecstatic experience of the Spirit of God. And these all will be signs of God's sanction on your kingship, because Saul wasn't stupid. He had to know that the idea of a human king over Israel would be very offensive to God, because it constituted an infringement upon God's authority. So Saul, if he was a faithful man at all, would have been very reluctant to accept this anointing as king. And so after this ecstatic spiritual experience that's chronicled in verses 6, 7, and 8, Saul receives a renewal, almost kind of a conversion experience, if you like, as these signs are fulfilled. And in essence, this is confirmation of God's sanction of his elevation to king, despite the reticence and all the warnings and all this stuff.
The reason why I brought that up, I'm sorry, I just kept reading. And, mm-hmm. But because in the New Testament, you know, Saul also gets changed, where he changes his name to Paul, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, Saul was a pretty common name, and but it's intriguing that you would have Saul, who became Paul in Acts of the Apostles. The resonances with his original name and his behavior prior to his epiphany of Jesus on the road to Damascus, that only deepens our sense of Saul's original character relative to this first king of Israel who went south in a very bad way. I'm not saying that Luke, when he wrote Acts of the Apostles, intentionally misnamed the man who became Paul as Saul in order to exploit these resonances. I just think that it's a coincidence, or perhaps a divinely foreordained one, that a man named Saul, just as a king who in Samuel was behaving in a way very contrary to God's will, that this person in the New Testament who became so central to the spread of the gospel would also be named Saul prior to his renewal. But this renewal of Saul in chapter 10 is different, significantly different. Because when Saul became Paul in Acts of the Apostles, this was an enduring change in his life, where he went from being utterly unfaithful to God to being fully faithful in a way that few, if any, others were. Whereas with Saul, this is just all about the confirmation of his selection and the legitimacy of his anointing as king. That's basically what this is about. Yeah, it's a good question. Caroline?
Was Paul also a Benjamite?
I believe so, but I can't remember for sure. Yes. Oh, absolutely.
Like circumcision and baptism. Mm-hmm. You know, and so I'm thinking, you know, this Saul in the Old Testament versus this Saul in the New Testament, you know, but that's just a coincidence.
Well, it could be a coincidence, or some people say that many times what we regard as coincidence is simply God choosing to remain anonymous. And in terms of
I
wouldn't go so far as to say that there are no coincidences, only providences, because sometimes there can be coincidences that do not reveal or fulfill the will of God, or at least on the surface doesn't appear to. Our time is up.